You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is curator Julie Lazar. At the time that we first met, in the mid-1980s, Julie was a founding curator of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Los Angeles. Julie was relatively new to the West Coast, having transitioned from New York City, where she had served on the staffs of PS1, Center for Contemporary Art, MoMA, the Hudson River Museum, Rockefeller University, the Museum of Modern Art, and Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. In 1989, she began collaborating with John Cage on his only composition for museum, Roly Holy Over a Circus, commissioned by MoCA, that ran from September 12 through November 28, 1993. For the first few years Julie was at MoCA, the museum director, Richard Koshalik, referred to her fondly as the curator of everything that moves, which turned out to be especially fitting in the case of Cage's circus. She later was appointed director of experimental programs. Following its presentation in Los Angeles, Roly Holy Over a Circus toured to four other venues through 1995. The Menil Collection in Houston, the Guggenheim Museum Soho in New York City, Art Tower Mito in Japan, and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I too was a transplant, but from San Francisco, not so far away, although culturally just as removed. I had moved to Los Angeles in 1982 to attend graduate school at UCLA, completing two graduate degrees in systematic musicology, first an MA in 1986, followed by a PhD in 1992. After leaving MoCA, Julie worked as an independent curator and producer under the auspices of International Contemporary Arts Network, or ICA Network, engaging with contemporary artists in all disciplines, especially in time-based and new media art. Among her later undertakings are Pat O'Neill, Views from Lookout Mountain, and Agency, The Work of Artists, the latter comprising 14 new projects on the theme of interdependence for the Montalvo Arts Center. She officially retired in 2019. So welcome to All Things Cage, Julie. It's so great to see you.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to see you also. Wonderful.
You know that we ran this beautiful show last week all about Roly Holy Over a Circus, really in anticipation of our time together, which we have known each other for so long, you and I, that it seemed to me that it might be nice just to have a whole conversation in which we can reflect backwards on what our lives have been, shared as they have been through Cage, but also what we've brought forward with us, who we are now and how our lives are different, but maybe not so different, you know, from what they were. So I wonder if we could start. The audience has been given quite a bit of information about Roly Holy Over a Circus, and they've also had the opportunity to hear Klaus Schoening's beautiful piece, Just to Roly Holy Over, which brought tears to my eyes as well as yours to hear it again in that context. But I'm wondering if you could talk about kind of a little bit of the nuts and bolts of the show. So how did the commission come about?
Well, what's interesting is how did my whole career as an art activist curator start actually was in a performance of Merce Cunningham and John Cage's at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And I don't even remember the name of it now, but it was the early 70s. And I walked in, and when I left, I didn't like it. I mean, David Tudor was performing. He had wires pulling down from the ceiling. The dance seemed disjuncted from the music. There was a lot of sound and chaos. But I walked out, and the minute I saw Brooklyn, I saw it all differently. And I decided right then that I was going to dedicate my life to working with artists like that, who could change your mind. So
wow,
it's really true. Then years later, a couple of years later, by chance, I took a book from my friend's house where I was staying, Silence by John Cage. And like so many others, I was completely moved by it. So years later, after the founding of MoCA, which was to be an interdisciplinary, artist-driven, responsive, and experimental museum that I helped found, and I was one of two curators at the time, I'd worked with a lot of non-traditional and not well-known artists, except for the very first thing I did, which was with Lucinda Childs, John Adams, and Frank Gehry. 8 or 9 years in, then Richard Kaschalk, the director of MoCA, came to me and said, I would like you to now think of working with a well-known artist. And I had just read about your operas 1 and 2, I have to say, which had happened years before, but it was being written about and talked about still, and that you were so involved in. And I just said, without a heartbeat, I said, the only person I would feel really enthused about working with, and I don't know if he'd work with me, is John Cage, you know, a composer in a museum. And Richard Kaschalk, to his credit, said, well, then go see him. And that is really how it started.
And what year was this? Give me a year, roughly. Just roughly.
1989.
Okay.
1989. And so I wrote John, and he, you posted the response back. I wrote him this letter saying, I'd like to do a project or a show with you. I'd like to connect it to the Music Center. A lot of it would be about your music, and could I come talk to you? And he said, yes, I'm busy, but I'm doing things that can be interrupted. And so even though I was quite afraid to meet this giant figure who had influenced so many people in the, you know, literary arts and the performing arts and the visual arts, who I felt so humbled to have a chance to meet and possibly work with, I got on a plane and he opened the door, and that's how it started.
It's very sweet. Didn't he meet you at the elevator?
He might have. I don't recall that detail. Why do you recall
it? Because he always used to meet everybody at the elevator.
You know, I think
because he had to call it up. Yeah. So when you rang from downstairs, he would have to walk out to, actually, that's not true. He could ring the elevator from the inside of the apartment to bring it up. So he'd wait for you to get in.
Right.
He'd listen. And then he'd push the button. But for you, I suspect he walked out there and stood at the elevator.
I bet he did, but I was so, now I can't remember if that first meeting was the one that I brought him a cactus all the way from California on the plane to as a gift. But I did do that at one point, ridiculously thinking, oh, you know, he's made, you know, compositions with plant material. He may miss California, whatever.
But, you may have done it then, or you may have seen the apartment with the hundreds of plants everywhere.
Yeah.
And then on a return trip, brought him a little cactus.
No, it was a gift. I wanted him to like me. I wanted to work with him.
So it was a bribe.
Yeah, it was a bribe. And we sat down and we just started tossing ideas. I really felt that he was open. But I also felt, and don't really know, it's never been confirmed, that there was a little bit of interview test thing going on. Who is this person and do I really want to work with her?
Yeah.
And some of the first things he said, one of the first ideas was that he wanted to make an exhibition about circles. And I don't remember why we didn't do that. In the end, finally, with Roly Holy Over, there were a lot of circles included in the in the composition. Finally, and including Enzo's drawings or paintings that were curated by Stephen Addis for us. And they were these scrolls, these beautiful circle paintings were mounted inside shoji screens, and that shoji screen circular installation had to move around in the main circus according to chance. But We went beyond the idea of just an exhibition about circles. And I don't think it would have been beautiful, frankly, you know.
You know, Julie, at that particular time in 1989, he was really in the thick of the River Rocks and Smoke Works, the new River watercolors, all of those involving tracing around those rocks from the new river. With feathers and paintbrushes, also with a hand, whatever he was using. So he was working with circles a lot.
No, I know. He by chance he found a circle from his hot teapot, And he used that hot teapot also later in some of the prints that he was making.
That's exactly right. They were called Fire. They were from a series of Masostic, Fire, Water, Earth. I forget what the other one would be. Whatever. But yeah, he would use the little Japanese teapot as a branding iron.
He had smoke too. Well, now tell me, is this story true? So the Ryoanji drawings that are so beautiful, that where he took, you know, a measurement of the Ryoanji gardens and then would use chance to decide which rocks to use and which pencils and how many and where their placements were, like the garden itself. But I was told, or I have it in my mind, that he stole those rocks from the Ryoanji garden.
No, definitely did. No, no.
Okay.
You're not the only person who thinks that. No, but they were sort of replicated on them in terms of their shape and their number and the variety. And yeah.
That's why I'm glad we're talking, so you can clarify these misunderstandings. I have. Well, anyway, so that's how it started. And we had, I mean, the conversations went on and it just progressed for 2.5 years almost until he died. And it was interesting to try and raise money or try and get, you know, museums ahead of time to be a part of this, or even while I couldn't explain in detail every bit of what was going to happen. Oh, it's a project by John Cage. And people were open enough to him or had a ongoing relationship, as in the case of the Philadelphia Museum, that they were willing to take a leap of faith. And it got clearer and clearer, but it's still, after 28 or 9 years, difficult for me to describe. So thank you,
Julie, this reminds me of something that hit home to me really, really early on in my time with John, and then came back so strong. And that is that in my own life, in working with artists, and Cage epitomized all of it, but John was the most, he spoke to the truism of this the most of anyone I had ever met, is that, you know, art was never something that you could fully at any moment really describe, you know, that it was, as it was being made, you didn't know what you were making until it was finished. How could you? Because, you know, art was experimental. It had to be experimental by definition. It had to be. And I just remembered this whole experience of reading when Cage became the Norton lecturer. So same period of time, Julie, exactly. 1989 to 1990, 1991. He became the Norton lecturer at Harvard. And I remember reading, they had given him all these published books by the previous lecturers, the holders. One of them was Ben Shahn. And Ben Shahn had written this little, his Harvard lecture was called The Shape of Content, which I really liked this title. And it was a little paperback book. It wasn't even, you know, this ostentatious big book, you know, just a little tiny book. And I read it. And one of the essential premises in this book was that artists could not function in institutions. It just was antithetical. And the reason was that institutions were built on a model which was antithetical to art. That model was, great, you want us to underwrite your program. Now I'm tying back to you now. You want us to participate, great. Tell us in the end, what it'll look like. What will it be?
We were so fortunate, those of us who worked at MoCA, to first of all, start off in a temporary warehouse building. And then second of all, well, order is incorrect here, but the director that I was working with, Richard Bishalik, was open to artists' ideas. In fact, he was fascinated by them. He wanted the artists' ideas to be at the center of everything. And so we were really given permission. If we could raise the money and keep the thing going and not get overwhelmed by any obstacles, and in this case, including the artist's death before the project was completed, we were able to do it. Once the museum said go, we were allowed. So that resulted in a lot of interesting projects. I think it was a kind of golden age of the museum. And I think museum is almost a misnomer for what it was. It was more like a creation factory.
Isn't that lovely? You're so lucky. You know, and it's that kind of a situation was made for a John Cage.
Absolutely. And so was I, because I was multidisciplinary. I worked in all the contemporary arts disciplines, dance, film, theater, music, photography, architecture. So, and that was also a chance thing, which I don't want to take time telling about how that happened, but, and so I think it was a wonderful meeting of spirits, but Cage absolutely was still working with him, and his ideas are still opening my heart, changing my mind, and causing me to grow, thank goodness, you know. And
right.
Also, I loved working with you as well, but because we were like sisters working in this milieu of learning and of opening and of challenges, and we were constantly busy.
constantly incredible.
Answering questions, and in my case, I didn't know if I was answering or not. I was always learning and exploring. So, but in all cases with Cage in this project, in Roly Holy Over Circus, whenever he would give us a challenge we couldn't meet, we'd discuss it, and we, you know, would try to do it. And if we couldn't, like he wanted a jacuzzi. So it's like, how do you convince four other museums in different countries to take a jacuzzi and put it in the gallery? Because he wanted in the Museum Circle gallery for it to be like life, like his loft, basically, with plants and books and all of the, you know, chessboards. And
Merce's jacuzzi. Merce had a jacuzzi bathtub.
Oh, see.
And that was a part of everyday life, every day.
Right. And so then when he asked about whether we could get the permanent collection lists from all the museums in the country, he already had the idea that he was going to run chance operations and take something from everywhere so that he could see this multiplicity of cultural objects and artifacts. And I knew from being on the inside of these institutions that mostly museums didn't want to share those things. Now with the internet, it's somewhat different because people were competing for funding and for the collector's attention and their gifts, et cetera. But so I posited back to him, what if we wrote with, you know, all the museums within a 10-mile or 30-mile radius of Los Angeles? How would that be? And he was like, fine, you know, and we did. And that resulted in him coming back and saying, so ask them for 10 objects that without telling them what kind of objects and without coercing them into participating. And then whatever institution that wanted to participate sent in a list of 10 objects, he'd use chance operations to choose it. And then we installed it in a similar way by using operations. It wasn't that anything changed after that other than the interaction of the public, which was great because they were playing chess, they were reading, they were pulling music out of the cupboards that were provided, they were trying to figure out why things were placed together in such an odd way and wonderful way and why things were high and why things were low.
Right.
And
it was one of my favorite things about that was the first time I saw a substantial number of works, you know, installed by chance. And it was so therefore the first time I ever saw, a little tiny work, you know, 18 feet up in the corner of a wall, two walls coming together where I could barely see it. Right. And I remembered thinking how beautiful it looked.
Yes.
You know, it looked so dear.
So differently. And so, you know, in this case, there were things from the Museum of Lingerie, there was things from the city, there were, you know, plates from this on the street, there were things that were juxtaposed, high art next to objects from you know, the maintenance.
Right.
That had a museum.
Let me stop you, Julie, just for a second, so our listening audience knows where we are, kind of in this conversation. We're really talking about the movement of the Roly Holy Over a Circus that's known as the Museum Circle. So this is the part of the show that really has chance determined selections from museums in the location in a 30 mile or something?
Mile radius.
Yes, okay.
And in each city where the tour went, each museum in advance had to go through the same process. And what happened was so wonderful because in our case, we had an education program where the people who lent us the objects came to talk about it. And we called it, I think, Roman coins and feathers or something. Ron had said he liked to see those kind of juxtapositions. And we told everybody to bring a slide of their object. And then we picked the order of the panel out of a hat, you know, so nobody knew who was going to go first and second. But what was so wonderful is almost every person looked somewhat like the object that they
seriously.
It was very funny. It was very funny. So, but and the way in which there's an openness in that space where people did play chess, and because MoCA is open or used to be open for free on Thursday nights, there was somebody who's arranged chess tournaments that they could invite their friends and they'd come and they'd compete with one another. And there were performative things that happened without us organizing them during that time.
Right.
What that did is also linked MoCA to a whole lot of other institutions we may never have worked with or thought of, and us to them and them to us. So their audiences also came to us, and our audiences, we believe, went to them, because it was just such a fertile experience. Mm-hmm. The next room, which I called the cage room, was devoted to his prints and some of his scores, as you described before. And that was in process. It wasn't finished when John died. We were talking about it because he was so humble. I don't think he really wanted something to be so focused on his work. I don't know. But I had seen I think you may have been there, but anyway, with John at the Reina Sofia, when they mounted a similar installation, at the same time, they also showed John's essay installation on the writings of Henry David Thoreau, with changing light and all the beautiful sound collage of the different treatments of Cage's voice. And so I already knew that how to install it from being with Cage and the curator there. And so I felt that he hadn't told me not to do this, and I'd gone and seen all these prints and chose the various works, and even some of the scores. One was lent by Betty Freeman, who was a wonderful patron to John and so many composers. But anyway, so that was a very quiet space. So you walk in, and even though that too had been installed by chance, it was a totally meditative moment. You would walk in and you would feel like you'd cleaned your palate. But nothing there, once it was installed, moved. So we didn't make choices on how to line things up. But I have some funny stories about the high-low thing as well. From there at MoCA, you moved into the main circus that was where we had instructions from John that everything had to move. And that's where the score Rover, that was a truncated word for Roly Holy Over, was designed by Andrew Culver and in collaboration with John Cage. And that was where everything moved in accordance to the score and the daily printouts that we used to get. And to watch, to see where the objects would move and how long they would be in which location, et cetera. So I feel like I need to take a breath here because I have a question or something. I have a question for you. So as this was proceeding, this meaning my dialogue and conversations with John, how was it being perceived by you on your end, because you were working so closely with him at the time?
Right, Julie, you know, there were so many things going on in that period that I don't actually remember this as taking kind of anything in the front of life at the time. I remember you coming from time to time, and that focused us, you know, around whatever Roly Holy Over needed. But when you weren't around, there were all these other things going on. The Harvard lectures primarily were in there. If you look at, I'm reminded of the Selected Letters of John Cage, which is a book I did a number of years ago. The last, it's in five sections, sort of chronologically ordered, and I do a kind of introduction narrative to each of those five sections. And the last one is really just does this kind of thumbnail sketch of what the last part of his life looked like. And it's breathtaking. I mean, it's really breathtaking.
There is some letter or something in the book that has to do with the circus, I recall.
Oh, I'm but sure.
That reminds me that what I haven't said is that, you know, once my initial discussion with Cage occurred and it was clear that he was willing to go on this journey, I set about reading everything that I could. I read all his books. I was lent by Franz von Rossum, who at the time was working on a Cage biography, and that sort of got dwindled after, for whatever reason. He said he would allow me to have 6 or 8 boxes of these correspondences that were Cage. He was filing them for John. And I asked Cage and he said yes. So I had them loaned to me and I read all of this stuff. So much so that when I started meeting the artists and the people who were involved in this correspondence and that who were going to be involved in the circus, I felt embarrassed because I knew if they'd had asked for a loan or if there had been some misunderstanding. And so I really knew.
That's so sweet.
And anyway, so I made lists of people who really seemed very important to Cage. And that's how the checklist started. I'd bring these lists and Cage would just cross some names off, some, and then we decide, well, should they have an object or would they just a letter or a
right. Zero? Right, something he had in his mind about them. Yeah.
And so he would, you know, designate an M for memorabilia and then a dot if it was supposed to be a big object and then whatever, cross it off if it wasn't something he wanted to even bother with. And right. It weren't just artists, though predominantly they were, but, you know, like we had a Buckminster Fuller map, Symaxian map and
yeah. You know, yeah.
Things like that. So
yeah.
We had, yeah. And then, you know, the crew, the staff of MoCA got very involved and would come to see John as well. So the head of the crew, the installation crew named John Bowser, who is responsible for getting all that furniture built. And we had translucent flat files because one of the instructions of John was the memorabilia should be in flat files. You should be able to see through it. So it had to be invented. It was put on wheels. It had transparent top so that people couldn't grab at the materials, but there were, you know, Nam June Paik had some materials in there and so did his wife, Shigeko Kubota, and Ed Reinhardt had an angry letter in there. And I mean, I visited all these archives and pulled all this stuff together, but.
Julie, where did those end up? Do you remember?
They had to be returned. Oh, you mean the flat files?
Yeah, no, the flat files.
Flat files, MoCA loved them and the education department got them and they kept using them. But I got requests from curators elsewhere, can we get this? And so I'd always refer them to John, who's no longer alive now, but he was pretty much the one who designed them. Uh-huh. And he also was the one who found an artist in Los Angeles who had all this great 1950s, equipment to build furniture with. He was really a painter, this fellow whose name I'm not remembering right now. I'm sorry, Thurston. Anyway, and he made those beautiful cherry wood cabinets. And
we have two of them. We have two. So for our listening audience, we're talking about all the furniture that was designed and then built for the Roly Holy over a circus show. And after the show and after Cage's death, obviously, because Cage never saw the show in its fullness, we inherited, I don't even remember now, we have one of the long chess tables or the tables that people played chess at. The chairs, I'm sorry to say, have long died. Those chairs were so beautiful, those little spindle chairs with the woven
seat. They were shaker chairs from a kit. So they didn't get handmade, but they got hand assembled.
Yeah, we still have, I think we still have 4 of them, but they're really, you don't want to sit in them. You know, they're just too, but the table is still fantastic. It's our main work table. Right. And then these beautiful shaker cabinets, I think you had 4 or 6.
4, okay, so at the end of the show, MoCA didn't want to store all that furniture, which by the way, toured to all the way to Japan and back and the other museums. So what we did was we drew straws for them on the staff, crew that had worked on it, including me and Brent and other people who were involved. And we just pulled straws and whoever got them, and I ended up with a shaker cabinet, thank goodness. But if I didn't, and then one of the crew members who had been responsible for taking the circus on tour to a couple of venues got the other one, Eric Magnuson, who's also an artist. So and the movable wall, so I'm skipping over things, and I hope that isn't too much of a problem, but we had to have movable walls in this movable room, and for some of the artworks, and those were subjected to chance operations as well, and the artworks that got placed on them, their locations changed on the walls. The walls, the movable walls literally got shifted around, and so they would have different relationships with other artworks and the flat files and anything else that was on the floor. Those things got used in storage, art storage. I think they might still be at MoCA. Cage Circus, right? They were also designed especially for the project.
And right.
There was also a thing called, we called the reservoir. So if an artwork, even a very important artwork's number came up, that and it had to move off the main, out of the main space and into this storage space, they would also be placed on movable walls, which were lined up. And it you know, so we were a combination of taking apart museum practice and following it simultaneously as best we could, because Cage never wanted the artworks to be hurt or
of course it was
wrong.
No, I had a very funny experience with Alexander Monroe. You know who that is? Yeah, Alexander Monroe did The Third Mind. That's the show that I was involved in just a tiny little way. But Alexandra, this is really just speaking to using chance elements to design a show, to put up a show, to install a show. Not so much to design it, but to install it. And she had asked me and Marguerite Roeder if we would want to design the cage room. There was one big cage room adjacent to Fluxus and for the Third Mind show. So we said, yeah, that we would do it. We would use chance, of course, you know. And so we came in and we had our little dice and we did all this thing and we put the room together, the whole thing. And then it was, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks later, we had the gala. And we were at the gala and Alexandra saw me across the room and she came running over and she said, is it true that you and Marguerite did that installation by chance? And I said, yeah. And she said, or what do I pay these curators for?
I mean, it changed the way people did shows. I mean, the curator at the Museum of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Ann Temkin, loved that she didn't have to have wall labels, that they could just be numbers in that main changing gallery. And she used it later for other shows that she did. And in fact, I just received a request about a year and a half ago, whether they could do a show of works that were in their permanent collection that were created by chance operations that weren't necessarily John Cage. Could we use the Rover score to do that?
Of course, of course.
Discourage her from that because the Philadelphia Museum of Art doing the Jasper Johns retrospective is already doing something similar in print collections in the two institutions, the Whitney, I guess, and the Philadelphia Museum that are
exactly.
But the number thing was really key. And one of my favorite detritus things that came from moving everything around by chance is that the walls that were empty started to develop a braille-like quality. And so, and especially when we deinstalled and everything was sent on to the next museum, the whole thing looked like a gorgeous musical score. I would have loved composers or to come in and or musicians and perform that score.
Right.
It's beautiful, and it's totally antithetical to what happens into a museum. The other things were like security guards. How could they secure artworks that were going to move? You know, if it was here yesterday and was over there, how could they possibly track that? So they just became very pleasant, like gallery attendants. They would answer as many questions as they could. And we brought the staff together to try and help them understand the ways in which their practice was going to be different. But, you know, one of Cage's instructions was that we had to have the artworks move in front of everyone during museum hours. It shouldn't happen before or after. And so some installers didn't want to be like performers. So they didn't. They were allowed not to, and other people took their place. There was always a registrar who was always watching the condition of the artworks. So for me, the level of complexity was wonderful because the audience was part of it, you know, their movement and their observations, the light, the changing natural light, which was required also or requested, the process of museum installation was a part of it. And then people could sit down and move the chairs around. People could really be more natural, you know, and not so unnatural, although they still were allowed to handle the artworks unless the artist had given permission.
Of course, so, of course.
Yeah. And there were a couple of people like Marcia Skinner had works on the floor that you could move the piece paintings around, and people did. I mean, the level of respect for that project was very high from the public.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody got goofy.
Every piece of that of your operas 1 and 2, going back to that,
yeah.
Where Cage, you know, there was no backdrop at the back of the house, and all there were these flying pictures. They were basically photographs, or they were just design elements, but they came in and out. And when they came in and out, all the workers were behind them, you know, getting the props, and they would stop and look like deer in headlights, you know. Shortly after that, I just think that they grew to rather appreciate being part of the show, you know, being part of what was seen.
Actually, the crew that did work the show, even years later, told me what a life-changing experience that was. It was very much, you had to be very devoted. You had to pay a lot of attention to what you were doing. You had to shift the way you thought about your job and be much more open. And that openness was palpable. And then I know you did a project where you had to explain how to do chants and operations in visual art capacity. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. But it was a really wonderful opportunity to speak to people that, as a curator, I don't normally have such an in-depth opportunity to exchange ideas about a show that we were working on. And people got invested in it. They really did care. You want to tell me a little bit about your process of what happened when you were...
Well, I was going to tell you a little bit about... So after Julie and John's show, after Rolly Holy Over, the museum world, I like to think, Julie, was never quite the same. Maybe not right away, but, you know, within a few years, it started to creep in, the effects of this what had happened to the museum world because of it. And so now we're fast forwarding. I want to say it was 2009, I think, with Jeremy Miller's show in the UK, traveling exhibition for the...
Every Day is a Good Day.
Every Day is a Good Day. But what's the name of the...
I don't remember.
Well, you'll know it. You would so know it. I can't remember the name of it. It's so terrible.
It'll I had the book me. Right here. I could tell you, but it's in storage.
It's okay. But my whole point was that when the touring exhibition people were reaching out to find where it was going to tour to, the various venues, we had to, of course, sell the idea to the other venues. And I just never forgot, we really had to open our minds and change them in talking to these museums, because one of the real stickers for them was this business about that they had to change the works every day. Every day that the museum was open, they had to change it. And none of the, maybe Newcastle, one of them could do it every day. The rest couldn't. They were too small. They didn't have internal staff. They, you know, so we had to open our minds about this. Like, what makes this in keeping if you're only going to change it once a week or every other day? Or, you know, what is it that's required of us in doing that?
In our case, you know, all the works didn't, nor could they possibly, because we had 150 artworks. Could they change every day? But a certain number of them did, and they did, that changing did take place in full view and all day long. And, you know, staff members had to leave and do other things and then return. So they had the time brackets. In other words, between 11 and 1230, you have to move these six works. So they could take off if they thought they could finish them all in 6 minutes.
Right. It's so cute.
But now, so let me say, though, that just to finish, we had a media space. Every institution had that. Every institution got a combination of recorded works and a disc clavier piano playing Eric Satie's Vexations, and that were all decided, you know, the order of which were decided by chance operations and announced each day. But in between, there were performative works by, Jackson McLow or Merce Cunningham or Janosch Nagezi. I mean, there were some incredible pieces, but each institution was responsible for curating those works and then performing the chance operations and then integrating them into their media space program. So people like Valda Satterfield from the Merce Cunningham original company or elder later company performed. So, I mean, there were these incredible things that were happening, but they could only be announced the day of, so that there wasn't anything that was more important than the next. But there was also something going on. And I want to go back to this John Bowser person on my crew. When we were meeting with John, he said, well, John, this seems like a very quiet circus. There's not a lot going on. And John said, well, do you have dust? And he goes, yes. Do you have the change of light? Yes. Do you have architecture? Yes. Well, then you have everything. You know, is what John said. And so anyway, you would walk into the media space wherever it was in the city and in each museum, and there might be Zen for Film created by Nam June Paik, which is just dust lighting on film, and there's no sound and it's just fluttering around. Or you might actually hear furniture music played by, you know, art students from Cal Arts,
right?
Kind of very full experience, even though John Bowser thought John Cage made a quiet circus. So anyway,
I wanted to say that's funny that you was that comes up, because one of my memories about the opening was the fact that this show was adjacent to a show by Joseph Beuys, and they were literally connected by a hallway, so you could at some point go down this hallway and there was a Joseph Beuys show. And I did that, and it was incredibly quiet. Mm-hmm. Everybody in there was behaving like they were at the museum. Whereas in the Cage show, we were all behaving like we were in a schoolyard or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was very different. I loved the fact that the people in it felt comfortable. They bumped into each other doing things. It was never chaotic. But see, in the main Cage gallery that had the Rover score, John did say no performances in there, just in the media space. And I think that was partly so that the all of this movement could become more apparent, and including the movement of the natural light, mm-hmm. you know. And so, I mean, if something, I don't recall that it ever happened, but if someone did try to perform in it without invitation, I don't think we would have stopped them, but it wasn't anything that was programmed. So that
nobody did that.
No, nobody did that. Although when I, in a different program, I took Essay, John's installation on Henry David Thoreau's Essay, to Korea, and there were performances. People wrote and called and asked if they could perform in there. Mostly it was slow, like Bhutto-like performances.
Yes, yeah. This was so in Gwangju. This was Gwangju.
Mm-hmm. It may be too personal to ask this, but the day that John had his brain...
His stroke?
Yeah, his stroke. You had called twice. The first time you called, you said, John is so happy with Rolly Hover Circus. We finished editing his number pieces. And I want to know, well, what did he say to you about his happiness? You know,
I think he was just so happy that it got done. Yeah. You know, that last day of his life was a very funny day because he was, on the one hand, very dreamy. He was dreamy. He was listless. He was dreamy. And on the other hand, he had all this work to do, all of these, like, work for you, work for Frankfurt and Cologne for anyway, there were these festivals coming up that they needed him to figure out his program notes, whatever it was. And he just wasn't interested in working. He was interested in sitting around and drinking iced tea, you know?
Yep.
So I'm sorry?
He spent a lot of time talking to you too. I mean, you said you had a very personal.
I had a very beautiful exchange, one in particular that stayed with me for a really long time. I mean, I still remember it, but it doesn't strike me as, it feels like a long time ago now. But at the time, I remember asking him whether or not I worded it something like this, that whether or not something clerical could be creative. And he said, you're living proof of that. And I thought that was very beautiful. And then I began, after he died, I began to really think about chance operations and think about numbers and the organization of things and the movement of things as an incredibly clerical and incredibly creative, you know, the way that he brought them together. So, yeah, but he was just, I think he knew he was leaving. I don't know that he knew he was leaving that day.
Right.
But he was pretty done. No, but he was always feeling like he was behind at those days. Like he knew that you were waiting, that you needed things, you know?
Oh, no. Well, I'll never forget also, though, showing up the next day, basically, after he died. I flew there to be with you.
With the cat. Well,
the cat
you brought a cat.
The cat came a day or two after I arrived, but what I have in mind was when we sat down together and we had a little time and we were registering our loss, which just had started because we were so busy. There was the prototype for the box, the silver box that became
the cookies. Yeah.
And inside were the wonderful, what were they, date oatmeal cookies?
We called them the John Cage cookies. They were oats and almonds and flour and
maple syrup. We ate those last cookies together. And then for John's memorial, you had them baked. You baked them, didn't you?
Everybody in Mercer's studio baked them. I made the dough, and then everybody took home a baggie and baked some in their ovens.
Well, anyway, I'm so glad that we are connected still, and I do still feel the life of John's work, which he used to say, I have my life and my work has its, and I want to honor your commitment to making sure the trust came together. Without you, it would not have happened. And keeping these, your philosophy about you want to see what John's doing now.
Yeah.
It's because it does work. The work, it does have its own life, I found, just from my own interaction with Rolly Holyover.
So yeah.
And it's, my love.
You're welcome. You're more than welcome. It really is a something that I do live by, in the sense that, you know, John was all about changing his mind, that he lived for changing his mind. What was, you know, what was happening now, and how did, could he think about something differently? And I think I grow the most when I'm confronted with having to think about something differently than I did, you know? Yeah. And that's very Cage. That's very much what I've brought with me in the now, you know, next year will be 30 years. Next year will be 30 years since he died. Can you imagine?
No, I mean, yes and no, but
I know.
But I still feel his presence. I love hearing the conversations on this series that you're doing. They're very rich and wonderful.
Mm.
And I'm you know, I know I was very nervous, and I hope not too nervous while we were speaking during this conversation about this project, but it was life-changing and still is. I mean, you know, every year someone calls me, every year I plunge back in, or I send them to you, or we navigate through the next generation of people.
No question. Let me ask you, Julie, and this is kind of, you know, girl to girl.
Yes.
Was it always a pleasure working with Cage?
Yes, although I did feel at one point that it was a little early on, he gave me his a Xerox copy of his phone book, and he sent me on my way, you know, you can call these people. And I did. I went to see Dick Higgins and Allison Knowles and everybody, Richard Castellanos. I mean, it was such an incredible, but I felt that if the feedback from them came in, he might have put a little bit more of an obstacle in my way. That may have just been my fear and my, but I did. I felt that it was nothing wrong with it, because I thought, that's good. If I can't live up to, you know, expectations, or, you know, if people sense that I'm not capable, I shouldn't do this.
Right.
But at the end of when John died, I remember the moments, weeks actually, waiting for Merce's decision. I did answer your question, which is I never felt unhappy, but I did feel that slight moment when he might have just sort of let me drift away, but it didn't happen. But now I've lost the thought about when John died. Oh, waiting for Merce. And I thought, if Merce says he can't live with as much change as would have had to come for him, because we were asking for loans John had granted of artworks from their private collection, as well as, you know, the whole experience, I would have shut it down. I didn't want to, but I would have, out of respect to Merce, and out of respect to John's love for Merce.
Yeah.
Merce was there, he let it happen, and, you know, yeah, the wealth of happiness and wonderfulness that's come from the resulting compositions are why I feel so grateful.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
But how would you answer that? Did you have hard times with him at different moments?
We had our moments. I would say there were moments, and there were moments around when he was particularly unhappy, when he would become unhappy. So this is just a very small example, but it was toward the end of our working together, when I had to go back to Los Angeles and pick up the pieces of my dissertation, or my PhD actually. Anyway, so I was going back to Los Angeles, and he had gotten someone to replace me, who was this young woman who had worked with him in Germany. And it wasn't working out. I was home at Elektra Slaninsky's house, Elektra York, packing, and I would get these phone calls from John. He was so unhappy that she had not shown up on time, or she had not something. This went on for several times throughout the day. So I kind of went over to his house in the afternoon, and I said, look, you know, I said something like this. I said something like, look, she's your employee. You're going to have to deal with this, you know. And he was furious with me. I mean, just furious. You know, it was the idea that he was anyone's employer.
Yeah.
You know, the use of that language. He said, you know, I've never stopped you. I've never done anything but encourage you. To me, you know, I was not your employer. We did things together, you know. So there were moments like that where his... sort of had this expectation that the world felt the way he felt about everything.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a little bit of not a burden. It was a little bit of it was just awakening. It was like an awakening when those sorts of things happened.
Well, you know, I was very moved by his, around to the end when we didn't know it was the end. I remember him asking out loud whether or not, he said he felt he didn't know, he was questioning whether he had done enough. And you know, here he had written all these diaries about how he couldn't improve the world. He would make
right
And yet at the end of his life, he was questioning. And my answer would be, yes, you did enough.
Yes, but you did more than enough.
More than enough. But I know there were disappointments. Some of them were related to verse and his constant travels.
Lots.
There were lots. But I think he loved you and he trusted you enormously. And
no question. It was just his own, you know, he had standards. He had these standards. Yeah. And he imposed them everywhere he went. He imposed them on others. He imposed them on situations.
Yes, and you could misunderstand that, or you could try and rise to the occasion. And I think you were much freer when you rose.
Yeah.
You know, he did not, when I said, no, I can't write all the museums, it wasn't because it wasn't possible. It's that I knew we weren't going to get
right. It would fail. It wouldn't work.
Right. An alternative idea, which he accepted.
Right.
So there were those kinds of things, you know. And
and you wanted to please him, but you also wanted to please him. I did.
Yeah,
I remember he would say, do you think we could do whatever? And I would say, oh yeah, sure. And he'd say, aren't you marvelous? And I used to think, oh my God, I would feel 10 feet tall, you know, just because I was open to, you know, taking on something.
You know, he was actually the most real. So, you know, the tales are told of that what an egoist he was in the days when he was drinking and smoking and, you know, wearing outfits and all that crap. Dedicated himself to changing, and he changed. He changed. Was he perfect? No. Would he want it to be perfect? No. Was he really believable? Was he always making an effort to do his best? I think so. I mean, and that's one of the pleasures of having worked with him, is that he showed us how that we could change too.
Right. You know, I also think, you know, I don't do it so much anymore, but I used to use it as a kind of qualifier when I would talk with people or answer their questions. I would say, you have to be very clear that when I came along, John Cage was pretty old, that I didn't meet him until he was almost, I think he was 70 or so. You know, or 72 even. I said, so anything that I'm going to say could be contradicted strongly by people who knew him when he was 30. Right. And they did, you know, they did contradict over the years. But the truth is, I think we got him at a really nice time.
Oh,
and I, you know.
Believe me, there's no way I could handle all of the complexity of what was involved in this circus and the tour. And then the added city circus that I put on top of it.
Right.
Couldn't have done it. So I'm, you know, I'm.
The timing was good.
I think the timing was right.
Good. Julie, thank you so much for talking with me today. I wish we lived closer. Julie, for those of you who don't know, lives in California and I live in New York. So we couldn't be any farther apart and still be in the same country.
Hawaii.
That's true. Oh no, you're not wrong. And I could be in the far reaches of Alaska.
Right, exactly. Thank you, Laura. And I hope we can talk again soon.
We absolutely can. Thanks, Julie.
Bye.
Bye.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.